Who goes first? A difficult question that nations are grappling with when it comes to the vaccine.
There's not a fixed blueprint. It has still proven to be extremely complicated.
Also, 10 years ago this week, the Arab uprisings began. We look back on how the promise of a new day fell short.
I said, be careful, because the elation of revolutions are not enough to solidify your gains.
I'm Carol Hills, and how to work out in space.
Instead of putting metal plates on a bar like you would and you're used to at a gym here, we have an air cylinder with a piston in it.
Okay, but what about zero gravity yoga? That and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We start with what's on a lot of people's minds, the COVID-19 vaccine. Who will get it and when? This is a massive challenge that some parts of the world are just starting to take on to fight a pandemic that's killed millions of people. Today, COVAX, the coalition organizing the global distribution of vaccines, says it has nearly doubled its supply, securing 2 billion doses. Dr. Richard Hatchett is one of the senior leaders with COVAX.
Science has given us the tools to fight the pandemic, but equitable access is what will enable us to win and to defeat the pandemic.
Hatchett says the hope is to start delivering the vaccine to dozens of countries early next year. But as we know, several countries have already started giving vaccinations. The World's Alana Gordon looks at how three places, the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Canada, are rolling out the first doses of the vaccine and how things are going to get more complicated moving forward.
You might have seen the video this month of 90-year-old Margaret Keenan receiving the very first dose of the UK's COVID-19 vaccines at a hospital in Coventry. Keenan was then ushered in a wheelchair through a hallway lined with cheering staff. It was no accident that Keenan got featured first. Dr. Richard Vautry with the British Medical Association says the country wants to send a clear message.
People who are in their 80s and 90s, if they contract this infection, are more at risk of hospitalization and more at risk of dying. So it's that priority group that we're trying to protect as quickly as possible.
If slots are still open, the vaccines have been going to frontline health workers. Next, the UK's priority groups are based on age.
Then it would be those in their 75s and over. Then it would be the 70-year-olds. We will also be immunizing those with particular clinical risks.
The UK's rollout is fast. It helps that it has a national health system, the NHS, that covers everyone there. This makes the daunting task of vaccinating millions realistic. People know where to go, and doctors like Vautry are readying to become vaccine sites.
About 70 hospital sites were vaccinating in these last week, and as a GP, my practice will be involved in giving vaccinations to our patients in the next few days.
A national health system that prioritizes vaccinating older adults and then frontline health workers, that's the UK. Across the Atlantic, Canada is also putting frontline health workers, older adults, and the people who care for them first. Derek Thompson jumped at the chance to get one of the first vaccinations. He works at a long-term care facility in Toronto.
It's an incredible feeling, actually, just to have something that will give us added protection against this virus.
Thompson has been a personal support worker for 20 years, but he's been drained. His facility experienced a serious outbreak of COVID-19 early on in March.
It was very difficult. We're looking after these people for years, and this virus had came and took so many so fast. We sat with residents who we knew were not going to make it. So we took turns sitting with this resident or that resident so they would not die alone.
In Canada, it's the provinces that prioritize who gets vaccinated. Dr. Isaac Bogosh is on a committee leading the rollout in Ontario. He says most regions are following federal recommendations.
Those who live and work in long-term care, those who are frontline healthcare providers, Indigenous communities, and elderly populations, namely people over the age of 70, should be prioritized.
Bogosh admits how all this unfolds can get really tricky, even contentious, as limited supplies of the vaccine arrive.
There certainly are debates, and people are starting to say, well, which frontline healthcare providers and even which long-term care facilities?
For the UK and Canada, the logistics of this Pfizer vaccine are tricky too. It has to be kept super cold and requires special transport. So some of the residents of long-term care facilities are having to wait, as are Indigenous communities in Canada's more isolated areas. But Dr. Bogosh says in some ways, this is the easy part. The rollout will only get more complicated as regions determine who's prioritized next. That's less clear in Canada than in the UK. for better or worse?
It's going to take several months before Canada gets through its top tier. And so we've got a little bit of time to really sort out the second groups who will be vaccinated.
Which brings us to the United States, where officials have recommended that healthcare workers and long-term care facilities get vaccinated first.
I'm ready. Let's do this.
And so on Monday, the same day that Derek Thompson, the care worker in Canada who got vaccinated, and nearly a week after Margaret Keenan got her shot in the UK, Sandra Lindsay, a nurse in Queens, New York, received her first dose.
I would like to thank all the frontline workers, all my colleagues.
Getting the vaccine to frontline health workers in some ways has been the easy part. But it's the states that are in charge of administering the vaccine, even deciding which health workers will get the first doses.
There's not a fixed blueprint.
Dr. Monica Peake is a researcher and primary care doctor at the University of Chicago. She worries about what will happen after this first phase, whether the people most vulnerable to the virus, socially and medically, will slip through the cracks.
So even with the rollout of phase 1A, it has still proven to be extremely complicated. And what it has done is given everyone a taste for how large the challenge is that lies ahead of us.
It's not clear how each state will prioritize who comes next. And so the rollouts of this new vaccine across the US, Canada, and the UK have all come with unique challenges and advantages. Still, the arrival of a COVID-19 vaccine in all three countries is a turning point. But Dr. Kritika Kupali at the Medical University of South Carolina was conflicted in her excitement to finally get vaccinated this week.
I think I have a lot of mixed feelings about this.
Kupali has responded to outbreaks around the world, including Ebola in West Africa.
I realize that as a healthcare worker, I am lucky to be living in a place like the United States where we're getting access to the vaccine, but I am thinking about all the other healthcare workers and all the other people out there who I wish had access to it as well right now.
She worries that the rush to get vaccines in wealthier countries is creating even more uncertainty for how those on the front lines and at risk of the disease around the world will gain access when they will be prioritized. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Next year marks 20 years of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Washington is still looking for an exit strategy as it continues to support the Afghan government. This week, America's top general, Mark Milley, sat across the table from leaders of the Taliban. Joining me now to discuss the significance of this is Andrew Watkins. He's a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group and a former political affairs officer for the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. Andrew, General Milley is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he spoke directly to the Taliban. Just how big of a deal is this?
Well, it's part of a pattern of very senior figures within the U.S. government giving attention, and some critics worry legitimization to the Taliban movement. Of course, Secretary Pompeo has attended diplomatic functions in the Middle East state of Qatar involving the Taliban and has met with them personally several times. And President Trump himself has been on the phone with some of the same Taliban figures that General Milley met. It's not breaking new ground, but it's certainly the continuation of a high-level diplomatic engagement.
What is the goal of the diplomatic engagement?
The goal is to continue pushing both sides of the conflict in Afghanistan towards a peaceful political settlement to end the war. This is something the United States has been trying to initiate and has found itself compelled to nudge both sides, both its partner, the Afghan government, and its long-term adversary, the Taliban, as both sides fear the consequences of a deal that is not in their favor. At times, it appears as if both sides fear this perhaps even more than the continuation of war.
So has General Milley asked the Taliban for specific concessions or specific things to change about what it's doing?
We haven't seen an incredibly detailed readout that's been released to the public. But we also know that the U.S. commander of military forces in Afghanistan, General Scott Miller, has frequently met with the group over the year. And in recent months, it seems that the message is probably the same that Milley brought, which is the Taliban continue to apply violence across the country. many in their movement seem to have this belief that violence and the intimidation from that use of violence is an effective way to pressure other Afghans into accepting the kind of agreement the Taliban want to enter. What Milley is very likely communicating to the Taliban is that the use of violence is no way to conduct a peace process, and that peace talks themselves are at risk if the Taliban keep their levels of violence as high as they are.
Does the Afghan government support General Milley and these talks with the Taliban?
There are figures within the Afghan government, including the president, Ashraf Ghani, and other senior officials who have proven at times this year incredibly resistant to the idea of talking with the Taliban. And it's easy to understand some of their concerns. Once the United States departs, the Afghan government, which is incredibly dependent on external foreign aid and support, and that goes for finances as well as the military presence there, the Afghan government is going to feel incredibly vulnerable. And it doesn't trust the Taliban to peacefully enter into a power-sharing agreement.
What about ordinary Afghans? What do they think?
I think the only thing that all people have in common is a fear of what comes next. Not just the universal fear of the unknown, but a fear that comes from a population that has suffered through different phases of civil war for over 40 years now. And there's very little faith in most people that whatever results from these peace talks, a U.S. departure is only ultimately going to be destabilizing.
Any indications of what the incoming Biden administration is going to do where Afghanistan's concerned?
President-elect Biden has a track record that almost no incoming U.S. president has ever had, which is a 20-year record of speaking about and delivering policy advice on this very country. But he has also long advocated for small residual footprints of counterterrorism presence. But the deal that the Trump administration made with the Taliban, signed in late February this year, specifically says that all U.S. and international troops will withdraw by May 2021. And so the Biden team is going to have a difficult decision whether they want to have a lasting counterterrorism presence or whether they want to keep the option to pursue this peace process and to keep this deal with the Taliban that they've made so far.
Andrew Watkins is senior analyst on Afghanistan for the International Crisis Group. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Carol.
And a quick good news update to a story we reported earlier this week. More than 300 boys kidnapped in northwest Nigeria have been freed. The boys were taken a week ago when gunmen raided their boarding school and marched them into a forest. The Islamist extremist group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the attack. It said the boys were receiving an un-Islamic Western education. But it's still unclear how involved the group was in the actual abduction. The raid took place in the state of Katsina in northwest Nigeria. The governor there, Aminu Bello Masari, told the BBC that the abduction was the work of bandits with unclear affiliations.
The way the operation took place, one cannot precisely say there is no Boko Haram at all. But those who operated are not Boko Haram, are not known to be members of Boko Haram.
Another thing that remains unclear is how exactly the boys' freedom was secured. On Friday, doctors were examining the boys and arrangements were being made to reunite them with their families. The attack was the third mass kidnapping from a Nigerian school in the past 6 years. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The coronavirus changed a lot of celebrations this year, including a big one, the 250th anniversary of Ludwig von Beethoven's life. Still, not even a pandemic can stop Beethoven. Here's Boyd Tonkin with an audio excerpt from the podcast The Intelligence, brought to us by our friends at Economist Radio.
Beethoven created his great achievements in music against the backdrop of illness, of insecurity, of war, of financial crisis. So, in a way, it's fitting that his birthday celebrations, 250 years after he was born, should have had to take place in a year of profound challenges. The interesting thing about looking at Beethoven's legacy in 2020 is that it now looks a bit different. Until this year, you might have said that his inheritance for music has been one of grand and monumental works. The Ninth Symphony, the Fifth Symphony, these major statements of a rather passionate and heroic kind of musical endeavor coming out of the Romantic era. But the funny thing about the lockdown experience is that it's a much smaller scale and more intimate Beethoven that has appeared to be more relevant for us this year. The composer of the 32 piano sonatas, of lovely chamber works for small groups of instruments, the private Beethoven, if you like, these have been the works that seem to have been speaking most profoundly to people in the time of the pandemic. And it's really, I think, a testimony to his endurance, his resilience, that this completely convulsive experience of having our world turned upside down has still meant that Beethoven can speak to us. It's interesting that when I asked the director of the Beethoven 250 birthday project in Bonn to recommend one work for this year, what he advised everyone to listen to was not one of the great symphonies. It was a little piece known as the Heilige Dankesang, which is a movement of one of his late string quartets. And Beethoven wrote it after recovering from illness. He was often ill. He had a really miserable and punitive medical history. But this was written in a time of remission. And it's a gloriously tender and intimate song of thanksgiving for survival and new life. And if you like, it really should count as the theme tune for 2020.
Boyd Tonkin writes about arts and culture for The Economist. Thanks to our friends at Economist Radio for sharing this audio with us. Languages morph and change all the time, picking up new words or phrases. But how is it finally decided that a new word is now an official part of that language? In Spain, every year, a language academy adds a list of new words to its official dictionary. This year, coronavirus and de-escalation were added. But some people want changes to be bolder. Reporter Lucia Benavides dug into the controversy and has this report.
If you speak Spanish, you might know about La Real Academia Española, or the Royal Spanish Academy. It was founded by King Felipe V in 1713, and its purpose was to, quote, unite the Spanish-speaking world, which Spain still ruled at the time.
La RAE definitivamente es una institución muy colonialista, ¿no?
Rosalía Velázquez is a copy editor in Ecuador. She works on novels, textbooks, lots of things. Over Zoom, she showed me the massive blue dictionary she uses. It's published by the Spanish Academy, which Velázquez says is colonialist. She points out that it took the Academy centuries to accept Spanish words that were fused with indigenous ones, a common phenomenon in Latin America. Still, the Royal Spanish Academy's dictionary has long been the go-to, and every year, the Academy's 40 or so officials gather in Madrid to add new words to the dictionary and recognize linguistic trends. But they've yet to acknowledge gender-inclusive language. Velázquez says the Academy still has a long way to go in order to really be inclusive. Spanish is a particularly binary language. Adjectives and nouns are gendered. Its plural form is often the masculine O. So, for example, a group of female friends are called amigas, and male friends are called amigos. But a mixed group, even if they're mostly women and just one guy, remains amigos. The Royal Spanish Academy says the masculine plural embodies all genders. It calls gender-inclusive language, quote, artificial and unnecessary. But linguistics professor Maria Soledad Funes at the University of Buenos Aires says some people who don't feel represented by the masculine plural have made their own changes.
Lo que vimos es que la X y la arroba se consideran estrategias poco ya...
Funes says that for years, the at symbol or the letter X have been used as a way to make Spanish more inclusive. You may have heard the term Latinx, for instance. But she says both forms have flaws. The at symbol is still binary. It represents both the masculine O and the feminine A. And for some, the X is difficult to pronounce in Spanish. One newer movement among Spanish speakers is to use the letter E.
Y la E, que viene a ser como una especie de neutro.
The E is somewhat neutral, says Funes. It works in the plural form to include everyone. So, for example, it's Latines instead of Latinos. And it works in the singular form. A non-binary person, someone who doesn't identify with either gender, might call themselves Latine instead of Latino or Latina. In 2018, student activist Natalia Mira made headlines in Argentina when she used the form in a TV interview about a vote to legalize abortion. She referred to government representatives, both men and women, with the gender-inclusive diputades.
Creo que los diputados... Antes que nada, van a tener que plantearse...
The journalist quickly interrupted her, saying she should use the male plural, diputados.
A mí en el colegio me enseñaron a hablar en castellano, Natalia, y es los diputados.
At school, they taught me to speak Spanish, he shot back. The gender-inclusive E is increasingly being used in Argentina and other Spanish-speaking places like Chile, Mexico, Spain, and Puerto Rico. Copy editor Rosalia Velázquez in Ecuador says with time, the Royal Spanish Academy will have no choice but to accept gender-inclusive language if enough people are using it.
Porque la cultura está cambiando y eso nadie lo va a parar.
Our culture is changing, she says. Our language is changing. No one can stop that. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. Talk about culture shock. When astronaut Chris Cassidy prepared to blast into space, there was no pandemic. 6 months later, he came back to Earth.
And so opening that hatch and seeing people with masks on and people social distancing at the landing site, it was a shock to us.
Reacclimating to Earth during a pandemic. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For migrants seeking asylum in Hungary, the door has been largely shut in recent years. Prime Minister Viktor Orban has implemented harsh restrictions, but the door may be opening a crack. The EU's highest court said this week that Hungary's policies violate Europe's asylum rules. We're joined now by András Lederer, who's with the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, a human rights organization in Budapest. András, in most cases, when people are applying for asylum in a country, they go to that country and apply for asylum inside that country. That's different in Hungary. What's the process there right now?
It's very different in Hungary. If you come to this country and you try to seek asylum here, according to the rules, you have to leave Hungary and travel to another country, either to Ukraine or to Serbia, go to the Hungarian embassy in those countries and lodge a statement of intent that you attempt, that you want to seek protection in Hungary. And then 2 months later, you will get a decision whether you can actually go back to Hungary and make your asylum application. This is a Kafkaesque situation where rules are absolutely arbitrary. So this new system has been in place since May this year. And throughout this time, only one family was allowed to come to Hungary and make an asylum application. Only one. All of the others were rejected, meaning they were not even allowed to start an asylum procedure.
And what about people who are simply trying to cross over into Hungary? When they come to the Hungarian border and they say, I'm seeking asylum, what happens now?
If they are seeking asylum at the border, the officers simply turn the person away back to the country from which they came from. There is no possibility to start an asylum procedure. Even if you are availing yourself immediately to the authorities, even if you are approaching the official border crossing, even if you fly into the Budapest airport, there is no way for you to start an asylum application. If you are already inside the country, for example, you arrive to the airport in Budapest, they are going to drive you down to the Serbian border and just throw you out of the country.
This EU court ruling says basically that Hungary was breaking the rules. What rules is Hungary breaking?
Hungary is breaking so many rules that we would need a whole evening show to list those. But the most important ones are the right to asylum, which is a protected fundamental human right in the European Union.
Will the EU court ruling force Hungary to change its policies?
These rulings are binding and immediately enforceable, which means that Hungary, even if it doesn't change the actual legislation, the actual regulations, can no longer apply these impugned rules. If Hungary keeps on applying these rules that are in breach of EU law, that means that Hungary will be brought back to this very same court and penalties, financial penalties, will be imposed.
This EU ruling, it was the result of 5 years of investigations into Hungary's asylum policies. 5 years is a really long time. How can we expect any policies in Hungary to change very quickly? I mean, won't Viktor Orban push back or simply kind of sit on his hands and do nothing?
I think that's a very valid point. The European Union has at its disposal several tools, even in these kind of cases, to speed up the procedure. It never happened. But this is not a Hungary-specific problem within the EU. And I think that despite talks and despite attempts to come up with solutions to that, the EU is still unable to address issues like the ones in Hungary, which would require very quick, definitive, prompt responses and not procedures that take on for about 5 years.
Andras Lederer is with the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, a human rights organization in Budapest. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All across Europe, this will be a holiday season like no other. Here's just one example. Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve at the Vatican will actually be celebrated at 7:30 that evening because of the curfew in Rome. For more about this very different holiday season, here's the world's correspondent in London, Orla Berry.
It doesn't get more Christmassy than a night at the Panto. It's about as traditional as it gets in Britain this time of year, where actors recreate well-known children's stories on the stage, hamming it up and inviting audience participation.
Look at her. How vilely she sweeps. I hate her. Yes, well, now you're all covered in spit, aren't you?
But this year, shouting back at the actors is, well, not really advised. In fact, most Christmas pantomimes in Britain are cancelled this year because of COVID. But Belgrade Theatre in Coventry in central England is taking a new approach. It's staging the Jack and the Beanstalk pantomime all online. Ian Loughlin is the theatre director.
But it is the story of Jack and the Beanstalk based in a lockdown situation with the giant having to Zoom and things like that.
It's Loughlin's 26th year putting on a Christmas panto, but it's his first year not performing it in front of a live audience.
Of course we miss the live audience because they're so much part of it. They're very energetic shows and we do them to full houses most of the time. So it's just nothing like it, you know.
Coventry, like most of the UK, is now under lockdown. Theatres, bars and restaurants are all shut until at least the end of the year. Across the Channel, in France, actors, directors and musicians have been taking to the streets. In Paris, they're shouting free culture in protest at emergency restrictions. The French Prime Minister reversed a decision this week to open theatres and concert halls ahead of Christmas. Bar and restaurant owners have also been taking to the streets to protest. They've been shut since October. In Italy, bars and restaurants are preparing to be closed down too. Livia Zoe Bizzare runs Da Lucia restaurant in Rome with her sister. She says their biggest worry is that they would have to close down for good after 82 years in business.
I just hope to keep working just to survive because
I just hope to be open for the next years.
Bizzari's great-grandmother opened Da Lucia in 1938. The restaurant closed down for 10 days when the city was bombed during World War II. And it closed only for the second time in March this year, when Italy went into lockdown. Bizzari usually spends Christmas Day with all the family at her grandparents' house. This year, though, she doesn't know what she'll do.
We are waiting for the government to speak because we don't even know if we can go to lunch with the grandparents or they want to be with us, but we are pretty scared. We are not sure.
In Rotterdam in the Netherlands, Herman Hel isn't sure what he'll be doing this Christmas season either. Hel owns 12 bars and restaurants in four Dutch cities. This week, the government announced a five-week nationwide lockdown, closing all but essential shops. Hel, whose bars have been closed since mid-October because of a government ruling, says he welcomes the stricter guidelines.
I think it's good they take the measures because by closing almost everything, I hope the virus will be gone sooner. And the sooner the virus is gone, the sooner we can open our industry again.
But all the restrictions have come at a heavy price.
We've lost in revenues almost 60%. We'll be back out of debts in 2025. So we lost 6 years.
Hel says all these restrictions go against the nature of the freewheeling Dutch people, but is hopeful the public will stick to the rules this time around. In Germany, a strict lockdown has also been enforced from this week. Christmas markets are forbidden and mulled wine stalls are all banned. Only essential shops can now stay open. In Berlin, the historic Friedrichstadt Palast Theatre has been closed since March. Christmas is usually a hectic time for the theatre's director, Bernd Schmidt. But not this year, he says.
Silent Christmas, silent night. I shut up, I sit at home with my girlfriend and that's it. So exactly what politicians asked from us.
Schmidt estimates his theatre has lost 90% of its income this year, but he's philosophical about the past 9 months.
We learned a lot about ourselves, about society, and I won't say it was a bad year. I think our ancestors, you know, they had much harder times than we had this year. Yeah? So it's like all the people fighting in wars all over the world, they have seen much worse times than we had this year. So everything is good.
But Bernd Schmidt says he never wants to relive 2020 again. And he hopes that with the vaccine, everybody will be able to celebrate Christmas as usual next year. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
This week, we've been reflecting on the 10th anniversary of the start of the so-called Arab Spring. People in the region are asking why the uprisings didn't fulfill the promise of greater democracy and a better life.
I mostly think about the naivete of revolutionaries and the hard lesson that they've had to learn, that revolutions are only the first stage in what is a very long process for change.
That's author Kim Gaddis. She grew up in Beirut, and she's now based at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Gaddis and asked her what stands out most from the past decade since the Arab uprisings began.
I remember messaging back and forth with a revolutionary in Egypt when I saw how elated they were that they had actually managed to bring down Hosni Mubarak. And they thought, this was it. This was a turning point. There was no going back. From now on, it would be freedom and justice and democracy. I said, be careful, because the elation of revolutions are not enough to solidify your gains. Because we had been through revolution in Lebanon in 2005, when millions took to the streets and managed to push out Syrian troops who had been occupying the country for decades. And that was a huge victory, but it was almost a Pyrrhic victory, because what happened was the Syrian troops were gone, but the system, the deep state, remained.
You were a BBC reporter when the Arab uprisings began. Take us back to those early days when massive crowds took the streets in Tunisia and Egypt. Where did you see the naivete?
As I was covering the State Department, I traveled with Hillary Clinton to Egypt just over a month after Hosni Mubarak had fallen. And she met with a group of revolutionaries who had been on Tahrir Square. And she asked them, how are you preparing for elections? Because that was the next big challenge. And the answer from one of them was, we don't do politics, we don't do elections, we just do revolution. And that was a very telling moment about the huge disappointment that was coming their way as revolutionaries, because the army and the Muslim Brotherhood were getting organized for the elections, and we saw the result of that.
So it's interesting, America's response to the uprisings were pretty diverse. In Egypt, Washington gave some vocal backing to the protesters in Tahrir Square. In Syria, of course, the engagement was very limited. Where do you think the U.S. played a helpful role in fostering democracy movements during the uprisings, and where did it fail? I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag, isn't it?
It's a very mixed bag. And I think Syria is a very big failure of the Obama administration. And it's very distressing to see that no officials from that administration have been willing to acknowledge where they've gone wrong and what they could have done differently. And it's very distressing to see President Obama say that him stepping back from that red line that he had drawn about Bashar al-Assad's use of chemical weapons, whereby he said that if that would happen, the U.S. would be forced to strike. And then in the end, he backed out from that. President Obama described that as one of the best decisions, or the one he was most proud of. That's not how it's seen in the Middle East, not only because it showed weakness, not only because it signaled that Bashar al-Assad could continue to kill with impunity, but also it opened the door to Russian involvement in Syria, a Russian involvement that has been absolutely devastating and deadly for the Syrian people. But the other place where the Obama administration went wrong with Syria is that they gave a lot of vocal support, which made the Syrian opposition think that the cavalry was coming. And then they gave only very little actual support, just enough bullets to sustain the opposition and the rebels, but not enough for them to win decisive victories against the regime.
I'm speaking with Kim Gattas with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So in Barack Obama's new memoir, A Promised Land, the former president doesn't make it sound like change in the Mideast was especially high on his agenda. Here he is talking about Egypt's authoritarian leader, Hosni Mubarak, in an excerpt from the book, used courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio.
I was enough of a realist to assume that had it not been for the stubborn persistence of those young people in Tahrir Square, I'd have worked with Mubarak for the rest of my presidency, despite what he stood for. Just as I would continue to work with the rest of the, quote, corrupt, rotting authoritarian order, as Ben liked to call it, that controlled life in the Middle East and North Africa.
Former president referring to Ben Rhodes there, one of his national security advisors and speechwriters. Kim Gattas, did President Obama's realism, in quotation marks, as he calls it, prevent grassroots uprisings from succeeding, do you think?
You know, I have to say, I find it really problematic to hear American presidents sound defeated when they talk about the authoritarian rulers of the region as though there is nothing they can do about it. And it's only because young people rose up that an American president could finally see the back of someone like Hosni Mubarak. These authoritarians are kept in place in large part by American support and by American money. And I'm not one to blame all of the region's problems on America. Far from it. I wrote a whole book about the responsibility of local regional players like Iran and Saudi Arabia. But really, American foreign policy is about status quo. And it is also a lot about interests. It is about values. And that's why they support human rights activists and NGOs and give funding to humanitarian organizations and USAID and all of that. But American foreign policy is also about access to resources, about selling weapons, and protecting peace treaties between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors and protecting Israel's security. So it's a bit too facile for American presidents to say, oh, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about these authoritarians. There is a lot that they can do. And it's time to rethink the traditional approach to the Middle East, where it is believed that it's either stability with a dictator or chaos if we allow democratic forces to try to undo a system. It isn't this terrible binary choice. That's not the only choice we have. Look at how things are unfolding in Sudan. Look at Tunisia. I think these are great examples of what can happen when geopolitical interests don't stand in the way of democratic change in these countries.
Kim Gattas is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's also the author of Black Wave, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the 40-Year Rivalry That Unraveled Culture, Religion, and Collective Memory in the Middle East. Kim, thank you very much for taking this look back at the Arab uprisings with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As we just heard, it's been 10 years now since fruit seller Mohamed Bouazizi's protest inspired a series of popular uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa. A decade on, Bouazizi is still mourned by his family. You can listen to The World's Conversation with his sister Lila and find more of our coverage looking back at the start of the Arab uprisings. That's all at theworld.org. 196 days. That's how long NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy spent in outer space this year. He took part in hundreds of experiments at the International Space Station. Cassidy also completed his 10th spacewalk and managed to find some time to record videos of himself playing soccer up there. Then he returned back down to a very different world. We're joined now by astronaut Chris Cassidy. Chris, it's great to have you.
Hi, Carol. Good afternoon. Great to be with you.
Now, I want to jump back to April. At that point, you knew you'd soon be on your way up to the International Space Station. But of course, the coronavirus pandemic was then in its early throes. How did that alter your preparation process?
So ironically enough, 2 years ago, I knew I was going to be in complete quarantine in March and April. I just didn't know that the whole entire world was going to join me there. The real impact was none of my friends or immediate family could come over to enjoy the launch in person. It was just our crew and a few people at the launch pad, and that was it.
Now, this wasn't your first space expedition. You've now spent a total of 378 days in space. That's the fifth highest number of days among U.S. astronauts. What's the experience like of returning back to Earth and reacclimating?
You know, our bodies are amazing things, and I'm convinced that the more you do it, the more your brain and your body just knows exactly how to flip the switch and adjust. When you come back to Earth, there's still a physical aspect to it, like you got to get your balance system used to working again. We have exercise machines up there, so our muscles are strong. They're just not used to working together, but the mental adjustment is instant after you've done it a couple times.
I just have to ask, you said you have exercise equipment up in space, but doesn't the lack of gravity affect how you use the exercise equipment up there?
It certainly does. Instead of putting metal plates on a bar like you would and you're used to at a gym here, we have an air cylinder with a piston in it, and we crank that piston up and down to deliver different amounts of resistance, air pneumatic resistance, and we connect through a series of linkages to the bar. And the feel itself, it's very, very similar. So the engineers did a great job of designing this machine. It's gigantic. It's a beast of a machine, but it works fantastic.
Okay, I just had to ask. So back to reacclimating. I'm wondering if it was different this time because you came back from space and are reacclimating in the middle of the pandemic.
Oh, no question about that. I left America in February before coronavirus was really affecting the population. And while we were in space, we were waiting and wondering, just as the rest of the world was, how it was going to play out by the time we came home in October. And we landed right in the thick of it. So opening that hatch and seeing people with masks on and people social distancing at the landing site, we knew intellectually what we were going to experience. But until you're there living it, it was a shock to us.
You were up at the International Space Station for 196 days. What was the goal of this expedition?
The goal of the station is the same throughout all the missions. And we're there to conduct a robust science program that exists now. And there's an international team of researchers that all participate in. And really, anybody can send their experiment up there. And so we activate, monitor, troubleshoot these experiments. And that's probably 60% of our time. And now, with the true goal of the manned space program or space program in general is to get to Mars, making sure that we've got really, really robust systems that can withstand those harder expeditions.
We're talking with astronaut Chris Cassidy, who spent 196 days in outer space this past year. Now, you weren't up in the space station alone. You traveled there with Ivan Vagner and Anatoly Ivanishin, Russian cosmonauts. What was your relationship like with them?
Oh, we're great friends. Now, the interesting part was I trained for 2 years with two other cosmonauts leading up to the mission. 3 weeks before we were set to lift off, One of them, Nikolai Tikhonov, was walking his dog in the woods outside of Moscow, like he's done hundreds of times, and a tree branch jabbed him in the eyeball severely. So he had to be pulled off the mission. And because it was so close, the other gentleman, the two cosmonauts kind of trained hand in hand as a pair, if you will, like a pilot and co-pilot. And there was not enough time for the other gentleman to train with a new buddy. So they replaced the two guys that I had trained with for 2 years with Ivan and Anatoly. And so we kind of came together as a crew 3 weeks before launch. So I knew them in passing because it's a small community of international space guys and gals, but I didn't know them on a working level. And we became great friends. They were wonderful guys to be with for 6 months, and I really enjoyed being up there with them.
Now, just how small of a space were you living in up there?
I described the living quarters. They say when you see a PowerPoint slide of the space station that it fits on the footprint of a football field. But that includes the solar arrays and all the external components, which we cannot live in. The living components, I like to describe it as maybe 8 school buses connected in different orientations. So it's bigger than people have in their mind.
Is there really any such thing as downtime when you're up there?
You know, we work really hard to mitigate mistakes. When you're flying an airplane, pilots have a thing called crew rest, and it's there for a reason. When you're fatigued, you're error prone. And therefore, we treat rest and sleep like gold. 8 hours of rest is always there. We generally work from about 7 in the morning to about 7 at night and then go to bed around 10. And so those couple of hours in the evening from 7 to 10, I generally like to do things that I can't do on Earth when I'm in space, like take advantage of the window, get pictures of our planet and that sort of thing. So that's what we would do in our downtime.
You mentioned all the pictures you take, and you have a wonderful Instagram account. You made an observation about looking back at Earth and seeing it as this single entity. I wondered if you could paraphrase what you said.
When you're looking down at Earth, it's just this blue ball of peace. I'm from the northeast of the United States, and I know that I-95 is at certain times you can't drive, but everybody's just at a standstill, or there's unrest in different parts of the world, and this year in cities in our own country. But you don't see that from space. You just see this giant blue swirled with white, brown, and greens, and amazing blue in the Bahamas. And it just reminds you that it's one planet that holds 7 billion astronauts. It's our own spaceship, and we got to take care of it and treat it right. And before going to space, I never was a big Earth-conscious person. That just wasn't part of my daily thoughts. But going to space made me much more Earth-conscious. Take care of the planet. The Amazon jungle is burning. You know, that's the lungs of our planet. And carbon emission, all that stuff, I'm much more in tune to now, having seen the planet from a different vantage point.
Astronaut Chris Cassidy returned to Earth this fall after 6 months in outer space. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks so much, Carol. It was great talking with you.
I say this with feeling. Thank God it's Friday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.